This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
You know, today we can say, well, okay, after 50 years of pulling apart extreme inequality, Canada, Northern Europe, the American dream kind of went there. If you want that American dream and you're not born rich, you're better off in Canada and you're better off in Northern Europe, where they make investments in public opportunity.
Is America's love affair with billionaires actually an abusive relationship? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to author Chuck Collins, whose new book, Burned by Billionaires, helps us better understand why having so many ultra-wealthy individuals in this country has a deleterious effect on society. We discuss what Collins calls the idolatry of wealth, look at examples of billionaires harming the environment and the public good, such as in the explosive growth in the private aviation sector, and then break down some practical ways to help solve the problem. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chuck Collins. Chuck is an author, and his latest book is Burned by Billionaires: How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. Chuck, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
I try my best, like probably a lot of Sea Change Radio listeners, to ignore some of the more dire news that's just inundating us, but you take a bigger picture approach with this book, and it's solution-oriented in the end as well. I wanted you to first explain how you are able to kind of muster the energy to do the work that needs to be done to chronicle the madness that we're in right now and this wealth inequality issue in particular.
Well, I agree. It's a shockingly troubling times. You know, I guess I was motivated to write this book because I've been kind of watching inequality trends in the United States, the growing drift as we pull apart. I kind of think the moment we're in is a symptom of that. You know, when societies become so imbalanced and wealth concentrates in the hands of the very rich, you know, they can no longer depend on majority rule. They have to become more authoritarian to block alternatives and to block the will of the people. But the other, I just want people to understand that these concentrations of wealth touch our everyday lives. This isn't something remote and out there. This is like the day-to-day quality of life, how we feel, our physical health, the air we breathe, what we eat, you know, whether we can afford housing or our children can afford housing, down the list, the billionaire capture of our society and economy is bad for everybody.
Yes. And maybe you can give some examples in your book of how this touches upon us in our everyday lives, because we don't connect the dots often enough in our minds. We think of this as billionaires as just this otherworldly class that doesn't affect us, but you do a good job in making sure that we understand that it absolutely does.
Yeah, I mean, I co-edit a website called inequality.org, so I get a lot of fan mail, not always nice, but you know, one guy just wrote to me, said, hey, you know, none of my problems exist as a result of someone else being a billionaire. And I had a nice correspondence with this guy, Greg. I said, hey, you know, look, actually, pretty much everything you care about that touches your life is being disrupted and undermined. So your health, the healthcare system, you know, is being kind of hijacked by these billionaire-backed private equity funds that are buying up hospitals and every possible, you know, part of the healthcare economy. Your voice and your vote, you know, the billionaires are basically robbing you of your influence and impact. They're capturing our political system. Housing, you know, it's driving up the cost of housing. It's squeezing people. The billionaires are kind of moving into the housing market and trying to get more wealth, extract more wealth from that. The environment, you know, we've not just climate change, but the billionaires are the super polluters. They're the super emitters. They're using their wealth and power to block alternatives, healthy green alternatives, you know, shutting down windmills and opening up, keeping coal plants open. So down the list, what you eat for dinner, the food system, your animals. I have a little chapter about how, the billionaires are understand we love our animals and we're willing sometimes to go into debt to care for them. And they say, oh, great. These people are willing. We can pay more. We can squeeze them harder. So every little piece of our lives, the billionaire tentacles are moving in to try to hoover up a little bit more of that wealth and undermine the quality of our lives.
I think one of the things that often gets lost in these type of discussions is that the billionaires are us in many ways. We forget that. It's not this us against them, in that we helped create this mess as people. We voted against our best interests. Look at who's the president of the United States, for example. I remember seeing the glorification of this mass wealth and being horrified as a fairly young man when I was watching that, like the Robin Leach Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. We've made this, and this is not new, right? This is since the Roman period. We have a fascination with wealth and power. But when democracy takes over and accelerates these billionaire issues, it seems counterintuitive to what democracy should be and what it was essentially built to do. But here we are.
Yeah. No, I think there's something. Well, first of all, what you're saying about sort of what I call wealth idolatry, the sort of, oh, we're all going to, and then our cooperation enabling the system to evolve. We sort of have to ask ourselves culturally, how much is enough? I mean, one of the things I try to do in this book is explain, okay, there's the top 10%, wealthy, affluent households. They tend to be looking up and wanting to be richer, but that the most of the power and responsibility for the current mess we're in is, I think, in the top 0.1%. Once you kind of get to the $40-50 million mark, Alex, which you and I are not there, but I think what happens is people's needs are met, their aspirations and desires are met, their children are set, they've got a private jet, they're at a certain point they're starting to buy senators and buy media outlets. And they're starting to use their power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power. That's the dangerous point. Up until that point, okay, people are consuming a lot. But above that point, they're warping and distorting the society to their own benefit for the most part. So that's why I think they're ultra, what I call it, the billionaire class, but it really is that top 0.1% who's gotten most of the gains of the last couple of decades.
We've chronicled many times in the past on SeaChange Radio the private jet issue, and you mentioned it in passing in our first SeaChange Radio interview. I thought it was really informative. I'd like you to maybe repeat some of these talking points for our listeners about the handouts that go into these private airports around the country and how it affects all of us.
Yeah. Well, it's a great example where the average owner of a private jet has like $180 million. I mean, we're talking about very wealthy people. We, as taxpayers and commercial aviation travelers, subsidize the travel of the rich. They only pay a tiny fraction of the real costs of their use of the airspace and use of these airports. And their emissions impact is 20 to 30 times greater than an ordinary passenger in an airplane. So private jets are, indefensible really on a warming planet. And yet I'm involved in a bunch of struggles where people want to build more private jet hangars, expand private jet services. It's a dangerous direction because they are setting off essentially a sort of carbon bomb of emissions in this environment. Private aviation, is about 16% of all the aircraft out there, but they only chip in about 2% of the cost of the infrastructure and these private airports. And there's one not far from me, Hanscom Field outside Boston, is entirely it's the second biggest private jet airport in the country, 38,000 private jet operations a year. They're building new hangars, tripling the capacity for private jets, which will add another 6,000-7,000 flights a year. Most of those flights, we've studied this. We have a whole project that looks at private jet excess.
When you say we, who is we? Sorry.
The Institute for Policy Studies, where I work and I direct the program on inequality there, we have a whole project that looks at private jets and how they, how we subsidize them and the harms that they cause. And we analyzed just that airport and found, half the flights are from 20 different, mostly private equity funds that own these jets, and they're flying, 300 operations a year. A lot of them are short hops. They're literally flying from like suburban Boston to Nantucket Island, which is, for those who don't know the geography, very close to Boston. And you could take a ferry there, a high-speed ferry, but instead they're jetting around for recreation purposes. So it's indefensible, and it's actually moving us in the wrong direction. And it's just another example. The wealthy are the super emitters. Between their big houses and their yachts and their private jets and the kind of high polluting style of life, they are driving climate disruption. And then there's a segment of them that own oil and gas companies and coal companies, and they're lobbying to block alternatives to a green transition. So they are huge drivers and hugely responsible for the ecological mess we're in.
Let's talk about some of the good billionaires, people who might share 95% of our values, and we would find them to be charming, nice people to hang out with. But I've heard often the expression that there are no good billionaires. And I think that's more of an indictment on a society that allows this kind of runaway wealth. Maybe you can talk about the flip side of the billionaire class and how we can learn from their experiences and how we can maybe deputize them in the fight against wealth inequality.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to underscore the individual billionaires are not a monolithic group. Some of them, I think of like Tom Steyer, have been very, very engaged in addressing climate change. And a lot of them have publicly expressed great concern about kind of the drift of inequality. So it's not about the individual personalities, some of whom are very annoying and some are probably decent people. It's really about a system of economic rules that funnels so much of society's wealth to the top. And I think it is important to say, well, there are groups like the Patriotic Millionaires who are, multimillionaires and billionaires who are publicly saying, hey, people like us, the Patriotic Millionaires, should pay more taxes and we should pay a living wage in our businesses and we shouldn't have so much influence and power in our democracy. We should have campaign finance reform. They're out there doing that and publicly saying that. And I think it's kind of encouraging. And I think that it actually represents almost a majority view among sort of maybe not billionaires, but among multimillionaires who kind of understand, like, it's not a good thing for us as a society to keep pulling apart and polarizing. That's going to backfire. And so I think there are some cracks, if you will, in the wealth holding worldview where there are potential allies. And I think our job as social movements is to say, not you should go away or you should be exterminated or, kind of any of these, a world without billionaires. That isn't that helpful. I think it's like we don't want to have an economy that creates so many billionaires. That's not a good thing for a healthy society.
Yes, you have a cartoon in your book that has two guys in suits on a private jet saying, one saying to the other, I would happily pay more in taxes if somebody made me.
This is a good example where the wider public, Republicans, Independents, Democrats, 70% think, yeah, multimillionaires and billionaires should pay more taxes. They're not paying their fair share. Even among the billionaire class, you hear Bill Gates say this all the time. Oh, people like me should pay more. Well, then we need, what's the problem? Well, the problem is that our political system has been captured by a segment of billionaires who are using their power to block sane, common sense tax policy. There are potential allies to be won over. And, not all the billionaires would object. As the cartoon says, yeah, you just got to make me do it. Well, so then I think we got to make folks pay that. We got to have a tax policy system that makes wealthy people pay their fair share.
There's just two kinds of people, the sinner and the saint. There's one that gets and always got, while the other poor one ain't. Oh, the rich man drives his Lincoln past the red light with a grin, and the poor man follows right behind in his little hunk of tin. There's a motorcycle copper following upon that trail. Oh, the rich man tears his ticket, but the poor man goes to jail. The rich man takes the high road anywhere that he may go, but when the poor man's traveling, he must always take the low. So if you're rich, you'll travel snug as peas are in the pod. Oh, the rich man rides the cushion and the poor man rides the ride.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author Chuck Collins. His new book is called Burned by Billionaires: How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. So, Chuck, what about markets and the way we have created this incentive system for C-level executives at companies to share in the success of their company, which sounds great on paper, but then leads to this billionaire class that didn't exist 30, 40 years ago of C-level executives? You see, this CEO is only making $3 million a year in salary. That's not nearly as bad as some other CEO, but they're worth $2 or $3 billion because of the stock. And that CEO can say, well, it was just built into my contract and the stock just keeps going up and up. How did we get to this spot in executive pay? And is there a way to untether markets from individuals?
You know, there was an interesting moment. I think it was in 1993, Bill Clinton was president. People were scandalized by the rising gap between average worker pay and CEO pay. I think in like 1980, it was like 24 to 1. By 1993, it was like 220 to 1. So people thought, oh, well, let's tax income over $1 million, tax CEO pay over $1 million, except for a little exception if it's in the form of compensation incentives in the form of stock options. So next thing you know, these top C-suite folks who were being paid $10 million were being paid $1 million, but they were getting $9 million in stock options. So it was kind of an unintended consequence that compensation moved more and more into stock ownership. But in fact, the market has just, you know, the particularly the stock market has increased so much in value that it's funneled huge amounts of wealth up to the top. So, you know, I just one point I would make is, these extreme inequalities of wealth actually undermine healthy capitalism. You have a segment of the economy that's speculating wildly at the top end with all this wealth, more and more moving money into the sort of gambling part of the economy, the highly extractive speculative part. And then you have wages stagnant or falling for 60% of the population, which undermines consumer demand. So I would argue too much inequality is bad for healthy capitalism. It undermines, you know, the goose that laid the golden egg that everybody likes to talk about. Too much inequality is bad for the economy.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author Chuck Collins. His new book is Burned by Billionaires. So, Chuck, we've established that billionaires are not a great thing to be overloading a society with, but you point to a lot of healthy, productive ways to reverse the cycle and the process. Why don't you give us some bullet points for moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it is important that the conversation we're having is just to understand how billionaires undermine our life. You know, you remember the phrase, it's the economy, stupid. My mother told me I could never call anyone stupid, but it's the billionaires, neighbor. It's the billionaires. So just helping people understand the connection, connect the dots between this updraft of wealth and the quality of their lives. In the end, we do have to tax. The wealthy are going to have to pay their fair share of taxes. They're effectively opting out and shifting the tax obligations onto everyone else. So we have to reverse that. And I kind of advocate for what I would call kind of game-changing campaigns where we tax the wealth and high incomes and invest in things that are popular.
For example,
Well, tax high levels of wealth and invest in debt-free higher education and job training. Tax luxury real estate transfers and invest in permanently affordable housing. Tax private jet fuel, make them pay the real cost of this extravagant luxury travel, and invest in green transportation and high-speed buses and high-speed rail. That's the formula. And by the way, taxing isn't just about raising revenue. It's also breaking up power, concentrated power. So to save our democracy, it's going to be absolutely essential to reduce these dynastic concentrations of wealth. I think, in this moment, in this kind of Trump moment, it's hard to imagine anything good moving at the national level. But we can, some of these things we can do at state and local level, to the extent that hasn't been blocked either. We have a bunch of cities that are progressive cities that are saying, let's tax luxury real estate and create permanently affordable housing. I think, and in the book, I really outline a broader program, but that is the formula. Tax the harms, tax the distortions caused by so much wealth in so few hands, invest in things that improve the quality of life for everybody. And you can build social movements because there's 40 million households that are holding some form of student debt right now. Well, that's a constituency for this program. Bill Gates' father, I mentioned earlier, I used to work with Bill Gates' dad. He was a huge, he got the GI Bill after World War II. It paid for his college education and his law school education. He always said we should have an economic opportunity recycling program. You're so rich and fortunate that you have that much money. Let's tax it and recycle it and create opportunity for people who aren't born rich. And that's, I think, a very compelling and popular program.
Just to play devil's advocate for a moment, I agree with what you're saying. But from a messaging standpoint, to try to push forward some of these things, a lot of the problems have been created by a very effective campaign from the conservative movement that has demonized the word tax and government. And so now we have the arsonists are in charge of the burning house. And so they can now say, see, government doesn't work because they're botching it up at every turn for average citizens. So we can say, well, why should we be giving our tax dollars to this inefficient use that don't align with our priorities and our values? So the problem is greatly exacerbated by this disconnect within the American voter. You mentioned how states and local governments can do something to fight back. What countries are good examples to look at in terms of templates for leveling the playing field in terms of wealth, Chuck?
Well, one country, I think, is the United States between the years 1945 and 1975. That was a period where the rising tide did lift all boats. The racial wealth divide narrowed, the gender wage gap narrowed, the middle class expanded. And that was because we taxed wealth under the socialist presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. We taxed wealth at incredibly high levels. That's a Bernie Sanders joke. He always says, under the socialist presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. The wealthy paid much higher taxes, and we invested in radical ideas like public infrastructure, first-time homebuyer loan programs, debt-free or low-cost higher education and job training, things that actually created a shared prosperity economy. You know, today we can say, well, okay, after 50 years of pulling apart extreme inequality, Canada, Northern Europe, those countries, the American dream kind of went there, meaning we don't have the level of social mobility we had, where if someone was born in the working class, they could become middle class, or someone born middle class could become affluent. That, mobility ladder has been stalled out. If you are not born rich and you want the American dream, and let's call the American dream not working 80 hours a week and retiring before you die and leaving something for your kids and, God forbid, owning your own little house, whatever. If you want that American dream and you're not born rich, you're better off in Canada and you're better off in Northern Europe, where they make investments in public opportunity. You don't graduate from college with, in debt servitude. If you get laid off, you don't have to go live in your car. you kind of have a basic social safety net and investments in things that make everybody have a decent life and have the opportunities. So we can learn from our own history, and we can learn from countries that have less extreme inequality, because their quality of life is so much better in those places.
We often think of the resource curse as something that only afflicts the global south, thinking of, Shell in Nigeria, for example, where there's this oil-rich country, but the living standard is just not on par with, let's say, Norway. Norway is a very good example in terms of it's a very oil-rich country, and they have not been afflicted by the resource curse the way Nigeria has. And I think some would argue that this country has been afflicted. We have resources beyond our wildest dreams, not just in tech, but oil. We're the largest oil producing country in the world, and yet we don't distribute those monies in any sane way, like Norway. How does Norway do it?
I think what happened is that those societies actually, and it really goes back to sort of this pivotal point around the 1960s. The reason we have all these immigrants from the Nordic countries from 100 years ago is those were very unequal, feudalistic societies, and people left and came here. But then they got organized. The workers organized, citizens organized, and they put forward the sort of the modern welfare state. Let's create a social safety net through which people can't fall. Let's tax the wealthy and invest in infrastructure and education and things that broaden opportunity. They've been doing that for a long time. The United States was sort of on that same course, but then in the mid-70s, we made this radical wrong turn, in my judgment, whereas those countries continued to expand opportunity. And now you're better off, as I said, the American dream is there. You're better off if you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a business. You're better off in those Nordic countries, Norway, Sweden, Denmark. They have higher rates of entrepreneurship. They have higher levels of happiness. They have lower levels of stress. The quality of life is really different. So they work to defend that common interest, that common good. And we kind of got maybe swayed into the individualistic, everybody go their own way idea. And as you said, attacking government, attacking taxes, and look, here we are. We've impoverished the common good. But we should take a look at those other countries and learn from them, and learn from our own 40-year experiment of great shared prosperity economics.
The book is called Burned by Billionaires: How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. People can go to burnedbybillionaires.com to find out about events surrounding the book. The author is Chuck Collins. Chuck, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex, for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Willie Bobo and Bob Miller.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.